Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We begin our program today on this anniversary that most of us want to forget, which never happened. June the 12th, 1963, Medgar Evers, the leader of his NAACP chapter, field secretary, was gunned down in his driveway in Mississippi. He was assassinated by Byron De La Beckwith, a member of the White Citizens Council. And we're going to reflect on that because that pain still lives in today's world, still lives with the family, still lives with people who knew him, still lives with those who have a memory of that moment. And we are joined here in studio by John Wesley, who's an author and a songwriter, senior fellow of social marketing with the National Center for Health Behavioral Change at Morgan State University since 2003. He has been a civil rights activist his whole life, grew up in Mississippi, the godson of Fannie Lou Hamer, and Medgar Evers was the accountant for his family. We're here with Dr. Ray Winbush, who is director of the Institute for Urban Research here at Morgan State University, and he and John Wesley go back many, many years as friends. It's good to have you both in the studio. Welcome.
Good to be with you. Good to be with you.
Let me start with you, John. I think of you as soon as – whenever I think of this, because I know that your relationship you had with Medgar Evers as a young man.
Yeah.
Just talk about what it was like before we talk about a bit about Medgar Evers and what he represented. But I just want to start with what it was like for you the moment you all heard that Medgar Evers had been assassinated in his driveway with his children in the house and his family at home.
Mark, I'll never forget it. My aunt Tidolia Mayfield, as I said, lived across the street from Megan in Jackson, in North Jackson. I had known him because he worked for Dr. T.R. M. Howard, who was the doctor from Mount Bayou, on the insurance company that where Megan worked. My grandmother and my grandfather had policies with that insurance company, so he came to our house, you know. And then he could watch the store where the Milam brothers were, where he was investigating the Teal case from our front porch. So when I became 13 years old, I moved to Jackson, June 12, 1963, okay? So the night that I moved to Jackson, I get there about 10 o'clock. About 12:30, my aunt runs into the house screaming, "They shot that boy. They shot that boy." Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, "What boy?" Megan Evers. I'm stunned, okay?
You now, were like the age of his children.
I was about the age of his children at the time. Now, the interesting thing about it is my uncle, Arthur Barber, was his milkman at the time. My first job was working on the milk truck. So on the mornings, Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday, every morning I would go and leave milk on those same steps in that same carport. Okay. So for me, to me, they had killed our insurance man. All that stuff about him being a civil rights, you know, I mean, it's kind of tangentially there. But the point to make is that keep in mind what Megan was doing in the early 50s. The Freedom Riders hadn't come yet, okay? The only people really doing work at that time were people like Marion Barry, who was working in Macomb, helping Bob Moses.
Your godmother, Fannie Lou Hamer.
And Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, people like that. But Megar, what he was doing it alone. And he was a special kind of person because, you know, you think back and you look at this guy. Now, look at the photograph of him, the iconic photo of him. It was actually taken by my great uncle, Richard Henry Beadle. The look on his face all the time with that sly smile. And this guy knew that the Citizen Council had marked him for death. And he did it anyway. That's the part about him that so strikes me early on. Yeah.
And Ray, I mean, this is not the world. You didn't grow up down there, but this, as someone who's a social thinker and someone who reflects on this in American race, I mean, talk about your reflections on Medgar Evers.
Well, I actually remember it, but I remember my father. I was living in Ohio at that time, and he was very angry. You know, I was, you know, about 15 years old at the time, and it was in a context of 63 in general. People forget that there had been two attempts on his life, one just 5 days prior to his actual assassination when they tried to run him down at the NAACP office, and then one in May, I believe it was, when they firebombed the same place, you know. And so, months later, not that many, or I should say weeks later, when the March on Washington occurred, that was fresh on everybody's mind. And then 3 weeks after that, you know, the four little girls in Birmingham, and then a couple months after that, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So all of that in my mind is kind of, when I remember one, I remember all of them. And I think sometimes we decontextualize the March on Washington from Medgar Evers' assassination, and they should be connected because everybody was thinking about that. In fact, I think some of the people who came there to express their outrage and grief at his assassination.
Can we take a step back? For our listeners, people know the name Medgar Evers.
Yeah.
Most people in America would say, oh, I know that name if it's said.
Right.
But we don't know much about him nor the work he did in Mississippi.
Yeah, he was born in Decatur, Mississippi, 1925. Decatur, Mississippi is east of Jackson, along Highway 20. It was not, that's why it was so normal that he and Merrily would both go to Alcorn. Alcorn is on the western side of the state. And
Merrily, his wife.
Yeah, Merrily, his wife.
Who became his wife.
Who became his wife. She met him there. And he was, you know, older than she was. But he went to Alcorn Mechanical School as one of the land-grant colleges. That, by the way, was the first school that Hiram Revels was the president of. And it was supposed to be named for Hiram Revels, who came from Baltimore, as we all know. But Revels refused to let them put his name on it, and the governor of Mississippi's name was Alcorn. So he named it after himself.
Okay. Of course, Hiram Revels being
the first black senator. Okay,
right.
He was Republican,
right.
You know. But he started here in Baltimore. He was an AME minister. But yeah, most people don't know about the rural. I mean, Decatur was in the rural part, and then he and Merrily moved to the Delta, Mount Bayou, where they worked for Dr. Howard in Mount Bayou, which was an all black town. Although Merrily came from a pretty well-to-do family in Vicksburg. So she was not too excited about going up to the Delta because she had never seen that kind of poverty. And also she had lived, you know, in a family that was pretty well-to-do. So to have the kind of subservience, to live with the kind of subservience that people lived with in the Delta was different for her. But for Mega, it was old hat because he knew the area.
And politically, I mean, being a member of the NAACP, working for the NAACP in Mississippi, was not a moderate organization. This was
the front line
of the civil rights movement.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think that a lot of people, when they talk about the NAACP now and then, I mean, you took your life in your hands
to be,
you know, a member of the NAACP. And the thing about Megger, you know, he was so outspoken and ahead of his time, as you pointed out, John, you know, so far ahead of his time in terms of doing some of the things that ultimately became like the core of the civil rights movement, the Freedom Rides and all these other things like that. So NAACP then was very different from the NAACP now.
Trust me. It was considered a subversive organization.
That's right.
And, you know, it was so interesting when my uncle, Gentry Black, and Amzie Moore, founded the Bolivar County chapter of the NAACP. Which is where Mount Bayou was located in Bolivar County. Now, Amzie had a service station, okay? One of the first things that Megger protested was the fact that African Americans were not allowed to use the bathrooms at white service stations. So everybody knew when they came through on the bus, if you had to go, you know, you tried to get to Amzie Moore's gas station so you could go. But that was one of the first. But keep in mind, too, it was 23 days for us in media. It was 23 days after Megger protested to the Federal Communications Commission and forced WLBT TV3 in Jackson to air his 17-minute speech on equality. It was 23 days later that Bynum Dealer Beckwith killed him. And, you know, when you talk about the White Citizens Council, keep in mind, they founded all of the academies in Mississippi that retarded integration, that is still keeping the school system there 88% black in 2013.
We'll talk a bit about Bynum Dealer Beckwith in a little bit. It wasn't convicted until 1994.
That's right.
For the murder he did in 1963.
Right.
But first, just to give a sense of Medgar Evers, we have a clip of him talking about a boycott.
Okay.
To give a sense of who he was and what he sounded like for those who may not know, may forget.
Yeah.
It's Medgar Evers' voice.
Don't shop for anything on Capitol Street. Let's let the merchants down on Capitol Street build the economic pinch. Let me say this to you. I had one merchant to call me, and he said, I want you to know that I've talked to my national office today, and they want me to tell you that we don't need nigger business. These are stores that help to support the White Citizens Council, the council that is dedicated to keeping you and I second-class citizens. Now, finally, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be demonstrating here until freedom comes to Negroes here in Jackson, Mississippi.
Piece from Medgar Evers. Just to hear
Thanks,
his...
Mark, for allowing me to hear his voice again. I mean, you know, and you can see the cadence. When you hear Dr. King's cadence and you hear Medgar's cadence, okay, you can see that kind of delivery, that the gift, what the Bible refers to is the gift of utterance. They had the gift of utterance. And he, if you notice, like Dr. King, he didn't put a lot of words into the space. He carefully and used it.
Deliberately.
Very, very deliberately. And one other thing I must say, Mark, understand how extraordinary it was to have an African-American male speaking that right. articulately and that powerfully at the time that he was doing it. I mean, yeah, but
Mississippi, 1963.
Mississippi, 1963.
And earlier.
And earlier. You know, this guy, you know, he got to the Delta. He started working in the Delta in 54. It was a year before, you know, Till was killed. But he brought that kind of articulation.
And one of the things, you know, Ray, I'm thinking about is that as we reflect back on that period that we lived through in the Civil Rights Movement and the work John Muzzy and I have been doing on this documentary we're putting together on Fannie Lou Hamer, is the strength of leadership, that people who were fearless, standing up in the face of not just segregation, of the violence of racism, of white supremacy. This is...
Well, it was absolute. And being a civil rights leader at that time was something... it wasn't easy to do because... You could have called yourself one, but if you were one, your life was on the line, literally on the line. I came to the South in 66, like 3 years after Medgar's assassination, and even students at that time, you know, if we said we're going to demonstrate, do some boycotting in Huntsville, Alabama, I mean, it literally could get you killed. And I think that there's kind of like an erosion of that now, you know. Sometimes I think being a civil rights leader right now means that you're wealthy, and I don't want to name any names, of course. And that
you can allude.
I'll allude.
Allude.
but then it was a dangerous, I don't even want to call it a job, because most of these guys had, you know, daytime jobs. They were doing this part-time, but so they didn't have to do it. But it literally put their lives on the line, and many of them died.
So when you think about both of you as teachers and you as a teacher at Morgan State University, why is it, A, important for people to understand this history? It might sound like a silly question, but I don't think it is.
No.
And how do you do that? I mean, what is it that you impart, and what do you think the responses are when you hear it from our students?
Well, you know, one of the things I think about, Mark, is that I try to, in all the work that I do, is to show that these were ordinary people who did extraordinary things.
Correct.
Okay, they were ordinary people, you know. And what I try to share with particularly African-Americans, that there is an inherent part of this that comes with you. What I say to students in general, and I say to people like you who's been so involved in this so long, who was somehow blessed with that equality gene, you know? I mean, you were blessed with something, and when I look at your documentary and I look at the way your friends talk about you and the fact that you wanted to help bring about equality. So when I talk to those people about that, I show to them the chances that people like Mega took, you know, and the fact that he was willing to risk his life to do it. But then I also show them how much more there is to do. You know, I'm working on a piece now called Mega Steps.
And mega steps.
Mega steps. You know, mega steps.
And
because when I look at his steps literally, you know, where I place the milk, but then I think about the steps figuratively in terms of what he did at WLBT. You know, what he did at WLBT, then later Randall Pinkston, who works for CBS, and I would actually start our media careers there. So I try to get young people, how do you find the connections? You look at the Home of Favor. You hear in Baltimore, okay? Look at what he did. I mean, how can you ride an MTA bus? How can you ride the Metro? How can you ride the subway and not think about Home of Favor?
That's right. Or teach at Morgan State.
I teach at Morgan State University. Right. I mean, you know, how can we see all of these great buildings, this great physical plant that we have at Morgan State University, and not think of Home of Favor?
That's right. You know, it was really popular during the apartheid era in South Africa. When you ask people what they did, everybody from a janitor to a professor would say, I'm a freedom fighter, and during the day, I'm a janitor, or I'm a freedom fighter, and during the day, I'm a college professor.
Right.
And I think that Megger, and I think, again, that we have to educate that way. People have to say, whatever you do, be it a Facebook, be it in the classroom, poetry, whatever, mm-hmm. being on radio as mm-hmm. a host, that you got to see that as an avenue or a place to teach people. And then your day job is something else. You know, we tend to describe each other as professors, radio show hosts, poets, and stuff like that. And I think it should be other way around.
Really?
We're freedom fighters, human rights workers.
You know, Mao said the poet must also be able to lead the revolution.
That's right.
If we don't, we lose something.
We lose something, exactly.
We lose something. So, I mean, but what is this? You know, well, before I go back into where we just left, like, I got to divert a little bit here. Byron de LaBeckwith.
Wow.
Who murdered this man,
right.
Medgar Evers, in his carport.
Right.
His children,
right.
They had a drill. And anybody who was in civil rights movement, everybody had drills. Right. If guns came up, you knew what you had to do. You had to dive, which they did. They hid in the bathtub.
Get in the bathtub.
And they came out and they were shaking their daddy, get up, daddy, get up. And daddy didn't get up.
Right.
Everybody knew he did it.
Right.
That's right.
Fingerprints left on the gun.
Right.
Left in the bushes.
That's right.
Okay.
And it wasn't until 30...
Registered to him.
Right.
It wasn't until 31 years later.
Right. And it had to do with the Sovereignty Commission papers.
That's right.
You know, the way it finally broke down was that although when the court said, okay, we're going to go in and we're going to try this guy again, what happened was that it was a guard who had overheard Beckwith talking about it at prison, and he talked about the fact that he did it. And when they brought this guard in to testify, and then there were some other witnesses that also came forward, they were able to do it. But it had to do with the Sovereignty Commission papers being
That's
open.
Right.
And the Sovereignty Commission papers, as you know, the Sovereignty Commission was set up by the state of Mississippi in 1961
right.
to actually monitor the activities of civil rights workers and civil rights and to block them.
And the thing also that hits me, Ray Winbush, is the ordinariness of people like Byron de LaBeckwith.
That's right.
The everydayness of who they are.
That's right.
Of raising their children, taking care of his sons, taking out his trash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The ordinariness of kind of what turns the system that allows this kind of person to become what he became.
He actually, in his day job, I'm going to use a four-letter word, but he sold fertilizer. And I think that ordinariness that you talk about shows, I mean, I don't want to quote Hannah Arendt, but maybe I should.
Why not? She's always good to quote.
Yeah, you know, about the banality of evil.
Right.
It's so ordinary. And that these people who killed, is not only the ordinariness of those heroes and sheroes, but those who killed and plotted to kill were very ordinary people. They had sanctions from on high, as you
right.
say, with
sure.
the sovereignty papers when they came out, but they were very ordinary blue-collar workers. You know, we can talk about James Earl Ray, the people that killed
exactly.
Emmett Till, all of them. Very right. ordinary, right. you know, kind of middle, lower-class type of white Southerners.
And
who are doing the work
Right.
That's
the
right.
beating of the wealthy folks down
exactly.
south who
exactly.
got who walked away hands clean.
That's exactly. right. Nobody, got, none of them went to jail.
Because right. they
none
pulled the trigger as much as the, Brian De La Beckwith right. pulled
exactly.
that trigger.
Right. They that's created right. the climate of consent.
That's right.
They
that's
okayed they murders like that. It was
oh,
their
yeah.
way. They ran the White Citizens Council.
Exactly.
He didn't run them. They ran
right.
them.
Right.
Oh, the guy who started, who actually started was an ex-white football player.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. From Sunflower County. In 1945, so people got to realize that when you look at Thurgood, man, and see that it is, and I always can bring this back to Baltimore. You know, keep in mind when Mega tried to integrate Ole Miss in 1951.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Wow. And he was turned down. His attorney, I mean, well, he tried to get in 1954. His attorney was Thurgood Marshall. Now, Thurgood won Brown versus the Board of mm-hmm. Education, but he lost in Mississippi. I mean, you think about it. And how did Mega get to Thurgood? Well, Thurgood was the friend of Dr. T.R.M. Howard in Mount Bayou. And it was through Howard that he got to know Thurgood, and Thurgood actually did that.
You know, I said something here, Ray. Having somebody like John Wesley around— mm.
He's walking like, encyclopedia.
History of that moment.
That's right.
Who knows?
But, you know, Mark, I felt so blessed, you know, to have been there. Now, keep in mind, at the time a lot of this was going on, I was on record, and I didn't see it in the kind of perspective.
You were a kid.
I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I was just kind of looking at stuff, and then basically going, wow, you know. I mean, looking at it. And I think back to the Regional Council of Negro Leadership that Howard started, and he mentored Rosa Parks. It was 4 days after one of his meetings in Montgomery that Rosa refused to give up her seat. Fannie Lou Hamer, Charles Evers, who came down after Mega was
the
killed.
The brother of Mega.
Yeah, because they had an agreement that if anything happened to the other one, that he would finish his work.
That's right.
Okay. But that to see those kinds of people— And to be able to look, and I knew that they were important, but I didn't really know why then.
Yeah.
It has been the years since that I've come to go on.
I always tell kids that it's very important to listen to your parents reflect the news. And I processed a lot through my mom and dad, who were always saying they would come home upset a lot of times, you know, when the girls were killed a few months after Megger
yeah.
was. I can remember my dad in Cleveland, you know, begging me and my younger brother to go hear this minister that was very important. And if I didn't hear, I would regret. I said, we wanted to go to a Cleveland Browns football game, and the minister turned out to be Malcolm X.
Right.
You know, and so I tell kids now, listen to your parents, process what they, you know, are interpreting about what's going on around. It's very important.
Well, you know, you look at Harold Carter. I mean, you know, yeah. I look right here in Baltimore, and I always bring it back to Baltimore. Oh, we worship Dr. King, and everybody mm-hmm. was so enamored with Dr. King. But who was his colleague? Harold Carter.
That's
was
right.
it the same church?
That's
I mean,
right.
who was it that was really very important right. in convincing Harold Carter that it's okay to follow the direction and become a minister? It was Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, mm-hmm. so, you know, if we really could just pay attention, you know, as Faye said, we listen to our parents. If we really can pay attention to who is around us,
right.
And we have so much of it here in Baltimore.
Right.
Well, we have to keep this is why we try to begin our program every day with this Living History segment,
yeah.
What happened today in history. And I got to thank Ray Wimbush, who puts this great history on his Facebook page
wow,
every day.
Wow,
it inspires me
right.
to kind of find
that's
out more.
Right.
See, he just puts all this stuff up here that you've just got to delve into. And I do. I always check and say, what's happening in history? The first thing I do is, what did Ray Wimbush write about today? So,
right.
so it is true. And I,
well, listen, Mark, listen. Everybody tried to sit close to him when we were at Yale, too, because he always knew what they were talking about.
Sometimes.
So, and I think that it is really important here to have the two of you here in the studio while we kind of reflecting on this. I mean, this is, remember, folks, we're talking, well, link to all pages today on our website at standardshow.org about Medgar Evers and what he was, what he stood for, what it means for today's world in terms of the continuing fight for social justice, the continuing fight to end white supremacy and racism in America, the continuing fight to either get rid of capitalism or humanize it, something to make this world a better place. The two men who join me here in the studio are two men who are dedicated to that as well. dear friends, Dr. Ray Winbush, he's director of the Institute of Urban Research at Morgan State University, and John Wesley, author, songwriter, senior fellow here in social marketing with the National Center for Health Behavioral Change at Morgan State since 2003, as well as being a journalist and the godson of Fannie Lou Hamer. Mm-hmm. And today we remember Medgar Evers and leave you with some songs and thought from Bob Dylan. And Ray Winbush and John Wesley, thank you both so much.
Thank you so much. Mark. Thank you so much, Bob.
A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in their game. The South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them, you've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose.
Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. What if you're struggling with your mortgage? The state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555.
In the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school from the start by the rule that the laws are with him. To protect his white skin, to keep up his heat, so he never thinks straight about the shape that he is.